You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 29 July. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Houghton, Johannesburg. On the show today, we're going to chat with Derek Jansen from Rensburg, iron ore results at Kumba, and rumors of a Sasol sale of their Lake Charles chemical project. Karim Chedid, investment strategist at BlackRock, investment case for Europe, and then Nalun Vapana. We're going to be looking at red flags to look for in fixed income funds. The show is proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. Morning headlines from CNBC: Apple's China iPhone sales jump 225% in the second quarter as recovery continues. And Business Day: Eskom win adds another 10% to cost of electricity. Morning markets, overnight we got the US was red, S&P down 0.7, NASDAQ off 1.3, Asia red, Sydney down 0.2, Turkey 0.9. Commodities mixed, gold the biggie, 1947 an ounce, Rand 1649, and top 40 opening call for a red open about 0.2% down.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Derek Jansen from Rensburg. He's a portfolio manager at Anchor Capital. Derek, morning. Appreciate your time. Kumba Iron Ore, those results. I mean, I suppose the key point is that they got an iron ore price, $93 a ton. At that sort of price, Kumba is, truthfully, they printing money. I mean, their margins are staggering.
Yeah, absolutely. I think really on paper, not a bad result. I think just from the outset, we would have expected a little bit more cash generation. Obviously, not a bad little dividend being paid out to shareholders in the form of about 20-odd rand. You know, obviously looking at a full-year number, that's quite a nice deal. I guess my concern would be how sustainable iron ore prices are around the current levels. As you mentioned, 93 is the average they kind of got to during the course of the year. You know, and I would be a little bit concerned. I mean, I see the share price obviously opened up a little stronger and settled pretty much flat on the day. I think, you know, if you're in the stock, I would tend to say if you've done well on it, I would probably look to just take a little bit of profit in it at these levels, but not a bad result. Obviously, you know, like all commodity stocks, you've got to stay very close to the door and then, you know, keep a very close eye on that iron ore price. And then obviously big bets on, you know, how quickly China will recover and how much demand or steel demand will obviously support that iron ore price as we move forward the next sort of 6 to 12 months.
I like your comment right there around commodity stocks generally stay close to the door. I've been chatting with a couple of people around gold stocks. It's become a crowded trade, and that truthfully, it's become a good trade as well. I mean, how do you base an exit strategy on that? I mean, do you just look at price? Do you? I mean, in the case of gold stocks, is it the gold price? Because you've done spectacularly well, but they're wild. Volatile.
Look, at this stage of the game, precious metals are really the hot flavor right now. So, you know, we've seen it in the likes of the palladium price also picking up quite strongly off its lows, you know, and obviously got the price moving towards new highs now. So, you know, the environment is still very supportive for precious metal stocks or precious metals per se. We are going to see sort of these lofty levels. Stimulus continues to come through from a global perspective. We're sitting on all-time low interest rates. So I would tend to say if you're in it, give it the opportunity to kind of run a little bit further and almost implement, call it a running stop loss behind some of these, call it stocks or even the raw commodity. For now, I think the wind is in the sails. I think that the global environment dictates for a little bit of a stronger precious metal price, particularly in gold. But yeah, as we mentioned earlier, stay very close to the door. You know, you could see a little bit of a relief environment in the short term, but as I said, kind of the 6 to 12 month outlook is still very supportive for gold as a commodity right now.
Yeah, give it some space, but I like that. Stay close to the door. Sasol typically gives us a trading update last week of July, which means today, tomorrow, maybe Friday. Some reports coming out of Korea around their Lake Charles project, that there is a company that's put in a solid deal to buy 50% of their Lake Charles project. But they're looking, apparently the price is sort of $3.3 billion, and that's dollars. The cost was $13 billion to build. The short story here is that Sasol's going to have to do a fairly marked write down on Lake Charles, largely because it was massive cost overruns.
Sure. I mean, I guess the question you've got to ask is how much of that news is priced into the current share price. I mean, we've seen obviously quite a lot of volatility in it of late. My sort of net digestion of that news, though, was net positive for Sasol. I think markets have seriously digested and kind of written off, call it, quite a lot of value, particularly on Lake Charles. I think the big question is, do they come to market and possibly do a rights issue? And, you know, obviously they've managed to skirt around the debt issue in the short term, you know, and raising a bit of cash. And if they do a deal like that, to me, it seems like it should be a little bit net positive in the short term, because really what they're doing is giving themselves a bit of leg room and ability to kick the can down the road on a potential rights issue. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, the macro environment dictates that low interest rate environments can give a bit of breathing room for debt-laden companies. So I would say it's net positive. Obviously, you know, bad capital allocation and not great to actually see you know, such massive write-downs on such a big capital expenditure spend. But all that said, I think it's good for them to actually get a offshore player to the party and to the table that can really add some value to the current infrastructure that's in place on the Lake Charles side. You know, again, I would, you know, watch it very closely. I think net-net, it was probably a positive result, just being able to raise a bit of cash, or you know, obviously when that announcement comes out. So I'm watching it quite closely. I think a lot of the bad news is probably in the price at the current level.
Yeah, and I take your point there. And the truth is that capital allocation was terrible, but that has happened. Now we've got to fix it, and maybe raising $3.3 billion, even if it's for only half the business, is better than not having anything. I like that. Derek Jenser von Rensburg, Portfolio Manager and Capital, thank you very much for your time this morning.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting with Kareem Chedid. He's an investment strategist at BlackRock. Kareem, appreciate your time this morning. A fairly comprehensive report put out by BlackRock, a couple of the highlights. The one that really struck out to me was a focus, a preference, I suppose, for European equities. Partly the stimulus is sort of catching up to the US, and in fact, Europe has announced a 750 billion euro stimulus package. Their pandemic response has worked better. That, you know, the disease is still out there, but Europe is looking sort of better in terms of the pandemic, matching stimulus, and therefore perhaps better investment opportunity going forward.
Yes, thank you for having me. And absolutely, that is one of the biggest changes in our investment views and our mid-year outlook. It's an upgrade to European equities to overweight in light of the reasons that you mentioned. Europe is managing the virus better, has managed to flatten the curves, even though the virus is still out there. We do seem to be exiting lockdowns in the region in a more sustainable way. And then the recovery fund is the absolute game changer, the European Recovery Fund, which is the 750 billion euro stimulus that you mentioned. And the biggest game changer here is that for the first time in history, the EU has come together to consolidate and have a singular financing facility for issuing European government debt that will support the region going forward. And that is a huge supporter for European assets. And the way I see it is it reduces the risk premium on European assets, which creates an investment opportunity in the region.
Europe almost comes out of this, and I say comes out, I mean the pandemic obviously still happening, under control in Europe, risks abound, but you know, if we go back to March and April, borders in Europe being closed, a lot of concern of how the concept of the European Union would survive, you know, open borders, here they were shutting them. In some senses, particularly as you mentioned, with this first of the stimulus package, Europe has perhaps actually come out of it as a concept, as a political and monetary force, coming out of the pandemic stronger than maybe it went into it.
Yes, in some ways, I think that statement is true. European Union, we always knew, was needing a crisis to come together and act. And so it was always going to be, how does Europe manage the next crisis? And this seems to be the crisis that pushed Europe into action. Which means that the way it's exiting, especially with the launch of this European Recovery Fund, where really for the first time the Germans have had a U-turn, where they're accepting to issue sovereign that supports sovereign risk of the periphery, such as Italy. So that is a huge change in the political rhetoric. Of course, there's still opposition. The recovery fund was not, it took some time to get a deal on. You still have what is called the frugal four, so a few countries in Northern Europe who were opposing some parts of the deal, especially the mix of grants and loans. But really the end point is this, that the European Union has seen a significant change towards more consolidated fiscal policy, which is supportive for the region.
Yeah, so you're looking for the quality factor as your favorite factor out there. Of course, you know, others would be value, there would be low volatility and the like. But a real interesting point you make, and you talk around the S in ESG, which of course S is the social part, and that coming to the fore. You know, ESG has been growing over the last decade or so, certainly in leaps and bounds in the last couple of years. And you're saying that from this pandemic, issues such as employee safety, companies, you know, their social purpose. Perhaps one of the outcomes of the pandemic in the medium to longer term is going to be a much sort of harder look at the social and the stakeholder role that companies are playing in their broader communities.
Yes, really ESG is a theme that we saw as quite important even before the coronavirus pandemic. It was already a huge focus for us from the perspective of launching new products that the investors can use. So as a business priority, it's been a very huge focus for us, but also as a long-term theme where we see sustainability and ESG as the way to invest at the core. But what the pandemic did is it first of all highlighted the importance of the S, as you say, where corporates that are hugely focused on employee safety, on employee welfare, really sprung to the fore, but also in terms of flows. So when looking at what investors have been doing in this market, amidst all the market volatility of March and February, and year-to-date really in 2020, ESG has been the most persistent investment trend. We've seen a record amount of inflows go into these exposures that outpaces the total amount that we've seen in 2019. And that is something bear in mind, because it's accelerated the trend that has already been at the fore.
Karim Chedid is an investment strategist at BlackRock. Appreciate your time this morning. When you protect your monthly income against the risk of injury, illness and death, you protect your future and the impact you make on those around you. FMI has been protecting South Africans' income for over 25 years, constantly innovating to provide greater claim certainty and cover for more occupations than ever before. Make your impact, protect your income first. FMI, life done better. FMI, a division of Bidvest Life, is a licensed life insurer and authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Nolan Vapanai, he's CIO at Anchor Capital. Nolan, appreciate your time. You did a presentation last week, a webcast on fixed income, and there was one of those moments in that presentation which, well and truly, you hear something and it just rattles through your head and kind of explodes your thought process. And your point was, you know, many times these fixed income funds look good, but you were looking for some red flags, and the red flag you put out was average credit risk is a metric used, but it's of no actual use. What you want to know as a potential investor is that lowest credit risk product within the fund, because that's the one that's likely to default.
Good morning, Simon. Thank you very much. Yes, indeed, that was a presentation I did last week, and I'm pleased to hear it sort of resonated. Actually, the thinking behind the presentation at the time was our financial advisors in South Africa are obviously more affay with equity products. Mm-hmm. And as income is becoming more prevalent and more important, the toolkit to necessarily really delve under the hood and understand that income fund, is maybe not there as much as it would have been in other products. So I'm just trying to share some thoughts on that. And, one of the questions that keeps coming up is, I keep getting asked about duration, but guys don't dig into the credit of the portfolio, which is actually arguably where the risks do lie. And understanding credit, absolutely, there are a lot of metrics that get published, but I question their relevance. The one you've identified is average credit risk. And this is something that I actually get asked by major asset allocators. It's also something that a couple of IFAs do ask me. When you look at a portfolio, it would be very easy for me, for instance, to take a portfolio of government bonds that theoretically are highly, highly rated and mix in just a few Eskom bonds that unguaranteed Eskom, which would be pretty lowly rated. And I could very comfortably say, look, the average rating of the portfolio is probably about AA, and that's a reasonable rating for that portfolio. Nobody would feel uncomfortable. But the truth is, you're still running quite a lot of credit risk, because if the forecourt does hit the fan, it is always the weakest companies that fall over first. Mm-hmm. We've seen that through the corona crisis, actually globally again, with weaker balance sheets coming under pressure. And those are the companies where you see big credit spread movements. People are concerned about corporate bonds right now, and those are the companies where you actually do see default events. So when looking at a portfolio, when you're chatting to your portfolio manager, it's actually very important to understand what the cutoff point is below which you won't buy credit. So you're not as concerned about the average quality, but rather the lowest quality that he's prepared to actually invest in. And the second very important question is, well, what happens if a company continues to deteriorate? We've seen, for instance, Eskom has deteriorated over time. Is there a point in time when you say, you know what, I'm going to cut my losses and rather get out of this particular exposure because I don't want the portfolio quality to drop below a certain level? So those are some of the key things I look for. And as always, I've got to caveat that with a comment of diversification is also key. So absolutely, we look for minimum credit ratings. We need to understand what the low point is. But nobody's got a perfect crystal ball. And the best defense from a credit perspective in an income portfolio is to understand when how much diversification there is. But when things go wrong, how big an impact can it be?
Yeah, that's a great point. Because I certainly myself, I look at duration, I look at yield, and I think that's all that matters. There's a heck of a lot there. We're almost out of time, but duration also matters, because you might take in longer duration can actually give you risk because you're locked in at a rate, and if yields start to rise, you're going to be locked in at that lower. So you've actually got to say, what is duration here at the same time?
That is true. I say that really your fixed income managers have three levers that we can pull, and we all pull them in different combinations. The first is credit. We've spoken about that. The second is duration, which has different dynamics. And the last one is a lot of managers then look to put alpha into the portfolio from other sources. So you'll see listed property, for instance, in some of the portfolios.
Yeah.
Coming back to duration, what duration is a less intuitive position, I guess, is the word, where people aren't familiar with it. But basically, the way I look at duration is the more duration you put into the fund, particularly with the shape of South Africa's current yield curve, the higher your yield is going to be. It feels very attractive. But duration creates a sort of wave pattern to your returns and the amplitude of those waves. So how big or small your over and underperformance will be over time is a function of duration. So if I'm expecting a return of 6% per annum, but I've got a little duration, I'm going to get close to 6% every year. If I've got quite a bit of duration, maybe a 3 or 4 year duration, I'll get my 6% return on average, but I'm going to see quite significant misses over time. So I might see a 10%, I might see a 2%. However, over time, that is going to average out to 6%. And that's really the effect that duration has on your portfolio.
Yeah, and it gives that volatility. And maybe your cash flow can handle that, but if it can't, be very aware. Nolan Vapanaar, CIO rather, of Anchor, chatting around fixed income. That's it for today. You'll find us live every weekday morning at 6:30 in the MoneyWeb website or the app, the podcast from 7. The show was proudly sponsored by FMI, a division of Bidvest Life Limited. Make your impact, protect your income first. The views and opinions expressed in this show do not reflect the views and opinions of FMI. Massive thanks to my team, to you all for listening, for my guests this morning. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.